Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the AgJam podcast. I'm your host, Belle Cheeves, and I'm here with Dr. James Gustafson, Associate Professor of History at Indiana State University. We'll be discussing his new book, just published in February of 2025, The Lion and the Sun, Environmental History and the Formation of Modern Iran. Congratulations on your new book, James. I'm so excited to have you on the podcast to discuss it.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm a fan of the podcast, so it's great to have an opportunity to come and speak with you and talk about this book.
Wonderful. So in The Lion and the Sun, you give us really a remarkable overview of Iran's environmental history from the Safavids to the rise of Reza Khan in the 1920s. This is not only a story about Iran, however. You weave together threads of local histories alongside and within regional and global historical trajectories and environmental trends. To me, The Lion and the Sun is also very much a history of labor, revolution, and empire, in addition to the environment, as well as the built environment. To begin, can you set the stage for us, or rather paint the landscape? What are the environmental and ecological conditions that you address? What makes the Iranian plateau unique within this larger story that you tell?
Oh, thank you. It's a great question. So, I mean, in part, one of my motivations for writing this was maybe 7 or 8 years ago, I was preparing to teach an undergraduate seminar on environmental history, like global environmental history. And while preparing for that, I just had kind of realized that many of the things I had done in my first book and that I had been working on in my research were pretty aligned with a lot of things I was reading and environmental history work. So I purchased this Oxford Handbook of Environmental History. It's this 700 or 800 page tome, right? And I was a little bit alarmed that there was not one single reference to Iran or the Iranian plateau, Persia, anything in the entire text. It's remarkable. There's lots of people doing really fascinating work on elements that we could call environmental history, but maybe not self-consciously. Mm-hmm. And Iran, I think, is really important for global environmental history. That's part of what I wanted to do, is not just incorporate environmental history into telling a different type of story about Iran, but make the case that Iran is actually vital to understanding global environmental history.
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah. So for one, I mean, much of the Iranian plateau sits in this rain shadow in the Zagros Mountains. So it's very arid. There's very little rainfall in most of that area. So it's an area that is dependent upon farming and pastoralism, but always kind of on the edge of disaster. And so many of the farms, especially in like Iran proper today, lie in this sort of ring where you have basically near highland areas where people are literally mining water out of the hillsides surrounding their villages through this system known as, you know, kanats, or they're basically, it just means a channel, like a television channel, same word, right? It's an underground shaft or an underground, like, vertical well, basically, or horizontal well, where you're mining water out of the water table in the hillside in order to just have enough water to basically farm and provide for the needs of a small community. And so you have, this, you know, water scarce environment that people are living in. And, you know, one of the other really, I think, unique features of Iran is the prevalence of mobile pastoralism, you know, people moving around with animals trying to eke out survival. If you had a large herd of, you know, goats or sheep on any particular piece of land for very long, you're going to very quickly deplete the resources. So you have,
right.
So it's all these really interesting things that make Iran unique, but it's also, I think, just as important to think about the connections that Iran has beyond, right? So, I mean, things like birds and forests and even mobile pastoralist animals, they tend not to recognize political boundaries. You know, they're not that polite, I guess. So we have all these things that spill over beyond. And then on top of that, while you have this environment of scarcity in a lot of the Iranian plateau, you also have the Caspian region, which is this lush, like old growth rainforests. You have maritime industries, silk production up until the middle of the 19th century when it collapses, right, under an epidemic that strikes the silkworm populations. Rice production, right? Caviar. It's interesting that you have this diversity within Iran as well. That's maybe not as
very much so. Yeah.
No, there's a lot going on. It was really incredible. I mean, I remember hearing about this in sort of my modern Middle East history classes, and but just reading it in your book as you presented it, it's really remarkable how many different things are happening in this, you know, somewhat. Not small, but, you know, somewhat confined space, if you will.
Yeah. I mean, it's actually a pretty large country.
Yes.
I mean, it's like more,
yes.
more than 1.5 million, you know, square kilometers. It's in the top 20, right? Largest, you know, countries in the world today. And it's even a much smaller version of what Iran has been historically, too.
Exactly. Right.
So, and as I address in the preface to the book, too, I mean, these are really current issues as well. I mean,
oh, very much so.
Right. So I begin like in the preface with this kind of anecdote about protests over environmental management in the Islamic Republic that have merged with these other issues over political rights and women's rights. And so things like access to water is a basic human need.
Right.
Dire shortages of water in Khuzestan. Like people have projected that large areas of southwestern Iran are going to be uninhabitable within a couple of generations, right? If we don't radically amend our relationship with our environment. So I think in any case where you're thinking about a new future, right? Carving out some sort of new path forward, it requires a different understanding of your past.
Absolutely. Very much so. And so as you alluded to in what you just mentioned, and as I also mentioned in the introduction, you really do a phenomenal job of showing how these local, regional, and global elements are all very intricately interconnected. And throughout your sources, there are sometimes different terms used for the various regional geographical formations that also sometimes map on to linguistic and cultural ones. And as we are Ajam, I'd be remiss to not ask you to elaborate on how the term Ajam actually comes up for you in the book. In your first chapter, you reference the term coming from a source in the early 19th century about the importance of studying history and geography together, where Ajam refers to a greater Iran. Can you tell us more about this and sort of these layers of regional and also global connection that really impressively mark your analysis?
Oh, well, thank you. So I'm a University of Chicago guy, right? And so I took these big seminars in Islamic history from people like Fred Donner and John Woods. And one of the first things they do is try to scare you by giving you this 3-volume work by Marshall Hodgson called The Venture of Islam.
Right? Uh-huh.
And it's fascinating and terrible all at the same time. But one of the things that's always stuck out for me in that book is this kind of reframing of history around what he calls the arid zone across Eurasia and connected into North Africa. And it allows you to kind of think differently about the geographical focus of your work, right? So drawing out connections between people living in common environmental zones alongside maybe the more well-trodden path of thinking about cultural connectivity, language, culture, experience of living under common systems of empire.
You know? Right.
Marshall Hodgson also was the originator of this term, the Persianate world, right? The idea of like thinking about how a shared kind of set of cultural traditions embedded in language and empire extend far beyond what we think of as just Iran today.
Right. And
environmental history, I think, is useful for helping us reframe things in interesting ways that as well.
Yeah.
So like the concept of Ajam, it's like on one level, it's this pejorative term, right? For people who are not good at speaking Arabic. You know, but it's also what is interesting about it, though, is that it's rarely applied to just like people. It's often a geographical term. Right. So it's like the land of the people who suck at speaking Arabic. Right? It's just this much bigger, this bigger idea. So it includes Iran, but also extends a little bit beyond it. Right. Same with this like Persianate world concept. So it's a connection between people and place that we haven't really adequately explored. And I think one of the issues that comes up on this book that maybe some people might not like as much is the idea that Iran is not something that's always existed, right, as a certain configuration of people in place, but it's actually a really recent thing, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
A new form of relationship between people and environment and place that's created out of these environmental pressures in the 18th and 19th centuries.
So another really impressive thing to me about the book was the variety of sources that you use. You know, you have everything from travel logs by people that historians usually avoid because they clearly didn't like Iran for some reason or another, but still included valuable information on agricultural practices. And you have things like this. And also you use like the rings in juniper trees as a source. What led you to these just incredible combinations of sources? Like, how did that lead you to this project and how it took shape? Just the threads you draw out and tell from the variety of sources is really just so impressive.
Yeah, I was told by more than one person that writing an environmental history of Iran would simply not be possible because we don't have those types of sources, right? So I think in part what I love about environmental history is it gets away from this trope of like the new archival discovery that's like everything is driven by like digging deep into the archives and finding some new source that's going to show us something different.
Right.
And that's great. And I don't, you know, mean in any way to say that, you know, other people's work doing those types of things aren't important because I work on that as well.
Yes.
But I think sometimes we need to use our sources in creative ways, maybe the
absolutely
things that we already are familiar with, but we ask maybe some different questions. So for instance, like you, I think you were alluding to Edward Sterling. So there's this, so this guy is, he's interesting, right?
And I was
I was in the archives of the Royal Geographical Society in London, and I came across some of his papers, and some of those have been published as travelogues and things, but he's kind of a jerk. I mean, he's...
he sounded like it.
He really is. He didn't think very highly of Iranians. Everyone is, you know, just refers to everyone as like, you know, feckless people, thieves, you know, just really critical of the government, you know, that basically what was holding people back was not just that you have lazy peasants, but that, you know, they're run by these hopelessly backwards elites. And he was always comparing things back to his home in Scotland, right?
Right.
So he's talking about, you know, these little comparative points that come out in his work about like trying to make that point about how the Qajar system of government was inefficient. He tells us lots of little details about it. And when he's describing the lazy peasants and their backwards methods, he's giving us lots of information about agriculture. So I've had people ask me, why are you bothering with Edward Sterling? He's this sort of run-of-the-mill person who has, like, as a travelogue, like 50 others that are out there, and he just is kind of hostile to Iranians. Why even bother with him? Well, one trick we use as historians is to ask questions against the grain, but also to look beyond what they're trying to tell you, right?
Right.
So, you know, as historians, as you go through graduate school, you get really just drilled into you that like our sources are produced by people. They're subjective. Mm-hmm. And even archives are not randomly preserved things. They're, you know, collections of material that were important to people for particular reasons.
Right.
So they're not randomly preserved. What you can do sometimes, though, is take those sources and look for, we call like informal information, right? Things beyond what they're trying to tell you. So while Sterling is talking about lazy peasants and their backwards methods, he's also really, he's telling us about the state of technology. There's all these asides in there about what types of tools people had available. When he's complaining about the backward system of administration, you learn all sorts of things about what particular people are administering, what particular places and how. And it's not exactly like his intention to tell us some of that level of detail about agricultural practices, but it's all sort of in there if you're looking beyond the formal narrative that he presents to you. And then there's things like tree rings you mentioned, right?
So
in a way, tree rings are sort of an anti-archive, right? Because they're not they're not preserved for any particular reason. It's a sort of large amount of data that's sort of in some ways randomly preserved. You have to work with large data sets because obviously if you're working with one individual tree or, you know, 100 individual trees, there's a lot of just local variation, right? So you need a huge data set to work on this. And that's beyond my ability, right? So I worked with people who know how to do these types of things. It requires not just the big data stuff, but also thinking about the growth patterns of trees. It's like basically a a cylinder, right? It grows right. in a very particular way. You have to work with large amounts of data, but also make corrections for things. And in Iran, we just don't have a lot of old growth trees and not exactly great access to coring trees and those types of things as well. So, but I have a colleague at Indiana State named Jim Spear that I worked with on an article some years ago on climate change in Iran. And it really came out of just like a conversation over coffee, like, what can we do to sort of, you know, use available information to tell us something about climate patterns in Iran?
Right.
And he'd been actually working on this method for drawing out comparisons across regions. So there's this very high correlation, for instance, between precipitation and temperature and tree ring growth. And you can also find that there's correlations between precipitation and temperature in parts of Jordan and Turkey with the interior of the Iranian plateau. So in a way, information about tree ring growth in like the Dana Reserve and in Turkey in these very particular areas is indirectly information about climate patterns in Iran over time. So he was able to use the sort of big data method from a few regions to draw out a picture where we don't have direct information.
Diving more into the history itself and still thinking about those juniper trees as sources. One of the historical threads that you shed a sort of different light on through this lens of environmental history is that of the end of the Safavid era. And as you just said, there's been this dominant trend of sort of imperial decline that's often emphasized in historiography and very much related to the rulers themselves. But you tell us a different story with the added character of the Little Ice Age. Can you tell our listeners first, what is the Little Ice Age and how does it impact our understanding of the end of the Safavid era?
Yes, great question. So the Little Ice Age refers to a period of global cooling that extends between the 13th century and the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And it's marked by like not just cooler weather, but like with climate change today and global warming, by erratic weather and changes to the usual climate patterns. So it's not just a uniform, everything became 1 or 2 degrees cooler so much as you have these changes to climatic patterns.
It.
So
okay.
in some places that meant, you know, very cold and dry winters, sometimes right. 4, 5, 6 in a row. In other places, it could mean torrential rainfall, right? Monsoon mm-hmm. rains, flooding. So it's not so much just a uniform cooling, but a disruption to climate patterns that extended over this long period of time. But the worst of it occurred in the 17th century. And so actually there's this long-standing field of general crisis studies, you could call it, right? This goes back to like Eric Hobsbawm. So he was writing in So he was, you know, noting that in one particular decade of like the 1640s, we have the peak of the catastrophic 30 Years' War in Europe that, I mean, devolved into massacres, you know, refugees experiencing famine and disease. The English Civil War comes to a head that includes, you know, people rising up against their landlords and local governments. As far afield as China, you have the fall of the Ming Dynasty to a rural rebellion. So it's like, what's happening where you have so many angry rural people rising up across Eurasia? And I think the default explanation was sort of something economic, something with inflation, right? So I think what environmental history has been able to sort of fill in, or the environmental sciences really, just kind of looking across disciplines a little more, is that this happened really in the peak decades of the Little Ice Age crisis, where it was the worst. So things that impact agriculture, right? Thinking about agriculture is involving all of these inputs beyond just human labor and soils, also, you know, sunlight, and things that impact that can have this large ripple effect that we see in these rebellions and revolutions. So for the Safavid Empire, I think this actually flips the usual narrative about decline. The Safavids were, as we remember, in one of the most fragile environmental zones in Eurasia, and yet survived this crisis into the 18th century. It's more of a gradual unraveling, which I think speaks actually to the effectiveness of Safavid imperialism, actually, rather than as others have argued, it's, you know, the Safavids just sort of fall apart because of the personal whims of the rulers or the drinking habits of the Shahs is one of my favorites, I mean, that's like embedded in a lot of the well-worn narratives on Safavid history, rather than thinking about history as being driven by a few individuals at the top, I think we need to look more broadly at what's happening in society at large and extend that picture even into what other elements of their environment are participating in things like agriculture and pastoralism and such.
Right.
We have to think beyond human history as a sealed container, right? But that
exactly
it's part of a much larger story unfolding in what we can call, for lack of a better word, nature.
So something I really appreciated about your book is your attention to the Zands and Afshars and the period in between the Safavid and Qajar empires in the 1700s that so often gets left out of historical overviews of Iran. And you really beautifully tell us how this period is actually so important when you look at how environmental factors shaped tribalism and pastoralism in particular. What role did the environment play in shaping the movement of people and how different groupings of them took shape in this period?
Yeah, so there's a weird gap, right?
Between medieval,
early modern Iranian history and then modern Iranian history often begins with the Qajars. And
right,
the medieval or early modern period ends with the Safavids, which leaves us with this 70-year black hole
that
people don't study very often. There's really very little work on it. Some really good stuff coming out right now, I have to say, but it's still one of the least studied periods in Iran's history. What I think is important here is the sort of larger context of what's happening around the Afshars and Zand, right? So we have this narrative, basically, of Safavid Empire collapses. You have a power vacuum that leads to infighting for 70 years, the civil war described in various terms, right? And then the Qajars pull it all back together and you have the beginnings of modern Iran. But I think what's much more significant is what's happening behind all of this. So what effect did this disorder have on populations? What do they mean by disorder? All of the narratives, I went back to the chronicles a little bit, like Astrabadi, who worked on he was there with Nader Shah and kind of wrote a contemporary account of the Afsharids. You have Nami, who worked for the Zand. In their narratives, once you begin looking for it, the constant din of environmental crisis is everywhere, all over these documents. They're constantly in search for grain and provisions, like over and over and over. It's just trying to find enough people, enough horses, enough grain to keep their militaries going. And we see it in our sources elsewhere as like there's this wickedness and disorder that are described all the time in other sort of accounts, which I think is code word for settled people upset that mobile pastoralists are moving into settled lands.
Right.
And are otherwise sort of upsetting the balance of like farming and animal herding. So the combination of environmental crisis and the collapse of the Safavids had different effects on different populations. And so we have subsistence crises in settled areas. We also have pastoral nomadic groups that are being driven off of really marginal lands that are even more marginal now. And so as you have this sort of balance tipping, you have basically, you know, these very adaptable, mobile populations of animal herders moving on to better lands that are now not being farmed. But that upsets the sort of balance. And so you see in all of these sources, especially when you get beyond the formal chronicles and you look at kind of local histories and things, right? You have this like wickedness and disorder has descended upon us. And it's that pastoralists are moving into the farmlands and not being held in check by the system of government that's supposed to maintain a balance. And then I think we need to also reframe Nader Shah and Karim Khan. So they're often presented as the two bright spots, the two people who bring order, and people in cities love them, right? Because they're actually like providing a little bit of like resistance to pastoralists moving into their lands. But they're actually, I think, driving this environmental crisis deeper and actually running it straight through the 18th century. So while they're looking for grain and provisions, what they're doing is basically plundering their own settled communities that they're governing in order to build armies and bash one another in order to try to extend their control over the former Safavid lands. So they're basically taking people, animals, supplies from populations that are already in crisis. So for instance, like Nader Shah is often remembered as this like the single bright spot in the 18th century where you have this guy that pulls it all together for a moment, briefly builds like the largest army in the world. Think about the cost of that on ordinary people, right?
Oh, immense.
300,000 plus person army, right? Requires an enormous number of horses, an enormous amount of grain. And this is happening in a time of social crisis.
Right.
He, you know, sacks the city of Delhi. This is often mm-hmm. like the last great moment of Indo-Persian Empire, right?
Right.
The last time where this greater Iran is actually put into practice. But he was actually like doing this out of a position of weakness rather than a position of strength, I think is what's really clear from going back to that narrative. And it's not evident in the way that story is often told. But
right. No, not at all.
He was, you know, moving on to conquering areas in India in order to gather enough resources to sort of recover a little bit of the deficit, right? And in fact, he basically uses that money to cancel taxes for a few years on populations in the Iranian plateau. So the damage had already been done very deeply.
Right.
But I don't know. I think this weird heroic narrative we have around Nader Shah misses that bigger point that he's actually partially responsible for this black period in Iran's history rather than being a bright spot in it.
Turning to the Qajar era now, with your attention to the assemblages of not only the environment and people, but also animals and different ways in which humans and animals interacted with one another and their environments, one thread in particular really stood out to me that I wanted to ask you more about: labor. So you talk about both human and non-human animal labor, which was so fascinating. And I'm curious to hear more about the human labor in particular. So you write about different ways in which space is organized in the empire. And one of these ways is that elite families around the empire are in control of the land and what it has to offer. And it seems like the peasants and people living on that land just sort of went along with it. I'm so curious to hear more about what was happening there. You know, were the peasants, in a sense, just enslaved labor that went along with the land they were on? Or did they have some level of agency in their labor?
This is such a great question and touches on some important issues kind of underlying this. I think this was one of those issues where having a little bit of like a theoretical focus coming in and actor network theory was helpful.
Yes.
So this is like Bruno Latour and Michael Saris and many others around him developed this method of basically thinking about people as just one part of a bigger system or network that accomplishes work.
Right.
And so with like something like a system of empire, we normally write about it as a network of people that just sort of is out there in this, you know, ether.
right.
But it involves lots of like a flow of material things to animate empire, right? So they're collecting taxes, they're moving things like wheat and barley and maize and cotton and tobacco and wool. These are the things that animate empire. And those are all produced through intermixing human labor, animal labor, soil, insects, microbes, water, sunlight, any number of things. And those are all, Latour would say, is that those are all important pieces to understanding how that system works. And you can't just focus on the human element without thinking about how they operate in this bigger network.
Right.
So in a way, like imperialism operated by giving different layers of elites a right to the resources produced by those assemblages, right? So just reframing it slightly lets us see something different in it.
Mm-hmm.
So empire is completely dependent upon these assemblages in order to bring forward resources. So you can't have an empire without irrigation and sheep and mineral-rich soil. But we often leave those elements out of our descriptions of empire because they're absent from a lot of our sources. So we have to kind of fight back and push back against that so that our sources don't bully us too much and leave out things that are really important to it. So with like the labor question, for instance, it was interesting to see it from a different perspective, right? And especially trying to use our sources in creative ways and find some of those little informal references to labor and land practices and things. So I would say that, I mean, the general picture is that people farming a piece of land tended to have a right to stay there. And in practical terms, it was very hard for them to leave. But really, the land tenure system wasn't about that at all. It was, I think, about the right of local elites and up from there levels of administrators and governors and such to claim a portion of the harvest rather than particular plots of land and the people and farmers who are there. So it's not like they're necessarily controlling a particular piece of land and the labor associated with it. but they are entitled to a share of the harvest that is produced by that assemblage of people, animals, labor, soil, water.
Right.
So it's a small but important distinction, I think.
Right. Oh, it's so fascinating. That really is. Yeah, sort of adds even further nuance to the question. I love it. So much like your assessment of the end of the Safavid era that we discussed and how environmental history tells a bit of a different story than has been told to this point, you also emphasize different elements in the history of Reza Shah's rise in the 1920s, adding a bit more nuance to the usual story of Qajar decline and his potent rise. Can you tell us more about your analysis of this period?
Yes, I always found it a little bit off-putting that Reza Shah's rise to power is generally told as just the rise of a strongman with
right.
The biggest question out there seems to be like, to what degree was he brought in by the British? Stepping in, you know, taking power against an unpopular Qajar government, but often miss the bigger picture of what's happening at the time, I think is extraordinarily important and decisive. And I don't want to pick on anyone in particular, right? But it's like a very narrow vision of events that have entered historical writing on the rise of the Pahlavi dynasty. So we have at least three other big factors behind all of this. So first, you have, of course, a faltering revolutionary movement and a world war that unraveled the networks that sustained the Qajar Empire. You have on top of that a horrendous famine throughout the later stages of the war that was in large part driven by the fact that Iran was under military occupation by the British government and prioritized the war effort and exporting or moving supplies through the country outwards to the front in order to fight the war, turned a blind eye to the suffering of people within Iran. And I mean, roughly 2 million people died in the Great Famine, upwards of maybe a quarter of the population. And that's routinely left out of historical writing, which is just beyond me, honestly. But, and third, of course, you have the influenza pandemic, which is a big part of why that famine was so deadly, is that there was also these things play on each other, right? One reinforces the other. So a population already malnourished was especially vulnerable to something like the Spanish flu or the influenza pandemic. So, you know, in a way, I think that you can't be left out of the story. It's not, again, a sort of great man or a singular, decision to shift dynasties so much as there is clearly like this is like a bookend to the fall of the Safavids. You have it was exactly why I sort of end the book on that note is because you have sort of come back around to this issue of an imperial system in decline under environmental crisis. And by environmental crisis, we include also the human element of that that drove things like famine and disease forward. So I think it's an important reframing. And I don't really think it's appropriate to tell the story of the rise of Reza Shah, Reza Khan at the time, without reference to that bigger social picture of what sort of crisis he was presenting himself as a solution.
No, it was very effectively presented. It was really, really wonderful to read. And there is still just so much more that we didn't get a chance to discuss. Your really rich engagement with different theories of political economy and empire and nation building, modernity and other aspects of environmental history and what it means to really study humans and the environment together. Also, your attention to gender and the urban built environment and, you know, how all of these different elements are intersecting with one another. But our listeners will just have to read the whole book to learn more as I come to my final question. What do you hope our listeners and hopefully your future readers will take away from the book? If there was one main takeaway, what would it be?
I would say it's that we ignore the environment to our own peril. I really honestly,
that's a good one.
I didn't set out to write like a radically different version of modern Iranian history, but I acknowledge that the story that I tell in this book cuts directly against some very deeply held and long held notions. Things like the nature of the fall of the Safavid Empire is something connected to a global period of climate change that revered figures like Nader Shah and Karim Khan contributed to it and extended that deeper. That this affected relationships between people and their environments in some really unexpected ways that actually shaped what we know as Iran today. The Qajars you know, have this reputation for being sort of hopelessly backward. I mean, they were struggling to rebuild a system of empire in a really difficult situation. Very small population with a low level of production, given the situation they were in. A population scattered over a massive area with high costs for transport and communication, and rely on kind of indirect systems of control because of that. They're now also facing 19th century problems like inflation and global imperialism, while also fighting their own environment in some ways, right? Recurring famines, cholera epidemics, earthquakes. And that came with changing demands from populations over who government was supposed to serve and what it was supposed to do. So to say if anything, it's just that we need to incorporate a bigger picture that extends beyond people in order to really understand the dynamics of modern Iran's history.
Well put. Well, thank you so much for joining us, James. It has been an absolute pleasure to discuss your work and really such a joy to read.
Belle, thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak about the work.
A pleasure. I can't wait to assign it in my Iranian history classes, as it really just provides such a fantastic overview of the modern era through such an important and unfortunately unique perspective, at least in Iranian history to this point. The Lion and the Sun, Environmental History and the Formation of Modern Iran, should be available wherever you get your books. Thank you.
Thank you, Belle.